Hey, this is Mike Merles, lead developer of 4th Edition, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 69. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be picking the brain of Mike Merles at Origins 2008. That's right, this is the first installment of recordings from Origins 2008. In this episode, you're going to hear my interview with Mike Merles. This was the last day of the convention, and after a couple of seminars, so some of the questions I didn't ask are only left unasked because they were covered in seminars that I'm hoping to put out to you guys later. But before that, don't forget to check out the Tome's Summer 2008 contest. It is well underway and runs until the end of August. Answer 5 simple questions and be entered into a drawing to win a prize package brought to you by the contest sponsors Q Workshop, Green Ronin, Paizo Publishing, Sword's Edge Publishing, Sinister Adventures, Pulp Gamer, and Goodman Games. You can find the list of products as well as links to the sponsors on the contest page, so be sure to check those out at thetomeshow.com. And now, Mike Merles. Mike has been in the game industry for several years now, but his most distinguished credit is the lead designer for 4th Edition Dungeons & Dragons. From my experiences with Mike, I can tell you that the man has a real head for rules, as well as a passion for gaming. He had free time, and there was an overflow of people at Origins wanting to play 4th Edition adventures. So he dropped into the Amorphous Blob Room one day and ran games for 8 hours just for a love and passion of the game. Other than the seminars and interviews, every time I ran into Mike at the convention, he was running 4th Edition games and convincing people about the value of the system. So with that introduction, Mike Merles.
I'm here at Origins with Mike Merles on the last day of the convention as everybody's starting to head out and things are quieting down a little bit. Want to get some background information about who Mike Merles is before we get into some of the more specific things that have been going on recently with 4th Edition D&D and all that. How did you first get into gaming in general?
Oh, gaming. Wow, that's 27 years ago. My older brother, 5 years older than I am, got a copy of the 1978 basic set from friends of his who had recently upgraded to the 1981 box set. So to give you a sense of the new for 1981, that was really new back then. And my brother played D&D for probably like a summer or so, and then he grew out of it, and I was really interested in it because I really liked the Hobbit. I had seen the Rankin-Bass animated version of it, really got into it, thought Fantasy was really cool. He'll make up like some characters and mess around with it a little bit. And he was just going to throw it out. It's like, hey, why don't you give me your allowance this week, like $5 or whatever it was, you know, back then. And I'll give you the D&D set. You can have it. So I was like, sure, this is great. And that's where it all started. It was a while before I actually found a gaming group. Obviously, when you're 6, you don't have many people you can play with. But that's where it started. And it's always been something. It's been something that I've never. It's always been stuck. Yeah, I've always been stuck on. You know, it's just part of my. It's really. It's weird to think of the hobby and how it's so appealing and it can stick you for that long. You know, okay. And there's not a lot of other stuff I did when I was 6 I don't do nowadays.
Sure.
So yeah.
Yeah. You worked your way eventually through different companies and RPGA, and then eventually got the attention of people over at Wizards and are now working for Wizards of the Coast. Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges associated with working for a company like Wizards of the Coast that you didn't necessarily face in some smaller companies?
The harder thing is you have to have the right work ethic and the right approach. When you work for a smaller company, especially for freelance, and especially if you're just doing it for fun, you're just doing it for a few extra bucks here and there, you might be in a position where, you know what, you want to write a book about pole arms. And if someone wants to publish that, then great. If not, well, you don't need that money, you're not relying on it, so maybe you just think of what's another thing you want to do. You know, and then the next step from there is, well, companies with established lines, like White Wolf or Wizards, might have, here's what we're publishing next year, do you want to write part of it? And then you can still take it or leave it, but when you're working at Wizards, well, what's coming out next year is what you have to do. So you really need to feel comfortable going, you know, being able to say that you're into game design enough in the abstract that the specifics aren't always what you need to get excited about it. And a lot of that just comes from studying a lot wide different variety of games, getting to know not beyond just the, if you're an RPG guy, still being able to appreciate and understand board games, video games, computer games, collectible card games and stuff. And I think I've been lucky enough that I really like RPGs, but I also like games in general. So even though, like, hey, let, you know, we're doing the, let's do a book on clerics and paladins and priests and stuff, and it's like, well, okay, maybe I'm not a huge player of that class, but I can still appreciate and get excited about the design challenges of here's what people want out of those, here's what we're going to try to do. You know, so you kind of have to be a little bit of a chameleon to deal with that sort of changing, that workflow, that process of here's what you're going to be doing, and go out and get excited about it and do a good job. And that's probably the big barrier, I think, going from being the really extreme end of just the hobbyist to being the full-time RPG designer.
Do you miss some of the days working for the smaller company and having that freedom to do what you want more?
There are times, but I think a lot of it with what I like is, you know, with my own campaign, that's where I get to do whatever I want. And so I think it's a good balance, because I never feel like, oh, I have these ideas I need to get out that I can't use, because I feel pretty happy. And what I've noticed a lot of times, I do something in my campaign, I start refining it, then it sometimes ends up in a book. I miss it sometimes, but I think the benefits way outweigh, the wistful days of being a freelancer.
Sure. So. Well, if nothing else, you get to spend your days playing games.
Exactly,
designing games. So. Right on. You also are one of the hosts of the official D&D podcast, yeah, which is only slightly older than The Tome, mm-hmm, the greatest unofficial D&D podcast in existence. Talk a little bit about the process of putting together the podcast, and I guess how involved are you, I guess, in determining what's talked about, and as host, do you guys figure that out, or does somebody else at the company do that?
It's usually the host. It's driven by Dave and I, and we'll usually just look at what's coming out, and we just try to think, okay, if we were gamers, what would we, well, we are gamers, but if we didn't work at Wizards, what would we want to hear about, And really based it on that. I think the best parts for me are when I get to interview people from the company and really, just sort of start, hey, so why, and try to ask questions that I would want, even if I don't really know the answer, but what do people out there want to know about? It's easy to fall in the trap of, like, just doing the sort of ad copy. Here's what's in the book. Isn't it cool? Rah, rah, rah. And, trying to get down to actually the stuff that really, especially D&D gamers who are really thinking about D&D, to sort of get their, get things that interest them. Mailbag feature is always the best too. That's probably my favorite segment. Is we just answer emails for an hour. That's always really fun.
All right, cool. So let's look at fourth edition a little bit here. From the perspective of a Wizards employee, what has the fan reaction been as the process has gone on?
Yeah.
And now that the books are out,
I think people at first were like nervous and sort of, why are you changing the game that I love? And then as we revealed more and more, people got kind of like, well, this looks interesting, but man, it's not going to work, because they're sort of seeing slowly the pieces. And whenever there was sort of a void, I think people just naturally, it makes sense, fill in with third edition stuff and go, wait a second, this makes no sense. If you add this to third edition, essentially, they're saying this looks broken, but really the subtext was, this looks broken if you added it to third. And as they saw more and more of the system emerging, I think people have been pretty excited about it. I think there's what makes me excited about the reaction is when people say, hey, it's really fun to play the cleric now. It really is actually fun to play the cleric now. It's not, well, it looks like it could be better. Like, third edition really, like being able to swap out your spells seems really cool, and so you realize, I can prepare Flame Strike, but I still need to use that spell to heal, And that was like an iconic thing. Like, this is something which we're getting there. It's better than it was, but let's sort of finish the job, And so it feels like it's been pretty positive, like it's been pretty consistently. There's sort of things you look for, like how many copies are we selling, being the obvious one, which we're doing well there. And then, but the true test to me was, how is our RPJ events doing? And we had a really great response to, like, Living Threat Realms and here at Gen Con, and then the 4E preview events here at Origins, where a lot of people turned out to play those games. So it shows people want to play. They're not just taking a look at it, reading it, and going, eh, maybe not. They're saying, hey, now this looks interesting. I want to start playing. So that feels really good.
And I suppose ultimately you don't know for, 6 months or a year whether or not it really takes hold.
Yeah, exactly.
So time will tell.
Exactly. You can think of it as a process of, it's like a very long distance race. And you want to start well, and then you want to, continue on from there well, but you're still not done. You're never really done. You're always on the lookout to improve the game and keep it going. I mean, you could say 8 years from now, we could suddenly stop selling D&D players' handbooks, and well, that's bad, right? Like, whenever set for all, it's never done. It's always next month's coming, and you want to meet those challenges.
Sure. So I guess since you're always sort of looking long term, you take some of the. There's been a lot of people who are very vocal, and online and other places just against the changes and against fourth edition and all this kind of stuff. I guess you just sort of let that roll off your back as much as possible and say, give it a few months and see if we can turn these people around when they actually see the game?
Yeah, you can't let people dictate what you're going to do, especially through the internet, because it's very easy to let a few loud voices overwhelm things. Or you kind of look, there's sometimes people like, you know what, sure, this guy says he doesn't like it, but then you realize, wait a sec, this guy doesn't even like third edition. You know, like, you're sort of reading his past posts or previous reviews, and you're like, well, okay, if you don't like D&D, you're not going to like this version either. It's still D&D. But, yeah, a lot of it is you can't, in either direction, you can't say, okay, all these guys hate it, the game's terrible, let's change it, here's things that need to be fixed. But you can't do the opposite either of saying, oh, look, everyone loves it, great, we're perfect. You know, what you really want is to look at what people are saying and sort of separate the, you know, the wheat from the chaff of, like, how, look, this is actually really, you know, great example on the forums, people were saying, hey, look, skill challenges, we're not sure if these are really working. And so you could just dismiss it, like, oh, whatever, people just, they're afraid of the new concept, right? Just, I mean, kind of frankly, like, arrogant like that, which we don't want to do. You want to look at it and go, oh, hey, these guys are making good points. Let's go back and make sure, let's look at what we've said. Do we need to rot it here? Do we just need to maybe do a web enhancement or just talk a bit more? But we definitely pay a lot of attention. And when you see comments where you're like, oh, yeah, that's a really good point, that's something we need to address, we'll do it. You know, that's one of the things with Dragon and Dungeon Online is with that, it now being firmly online, that gives us a much quicker response cycle. And it's not, sometimes it's invisible. People don't always see that we're reading and thinking, because sometimes just by the act of commenting, you change the thread, right? If someone's, say, talking about skill challenges and stuff, and you see a pretty good discussion going, you don't want to step in as a WotC guy and say, oh, yeah, here's what I think of what you're saying, or... Because then, well, people now, they kind of know, I think they're more aware, well, we're being watched, so I don't want to just, you know, maybe that changes what they say. Or the guy who is like, well, I just hate this and you suck, shows up, and then that derails that thread, you know. So there are a lot of times when it might not seem like it, but we're watching what people are saying. We're paying a lot of attention.
Okay. Let's talk about some more specific things in terms of 4th edition, some changes. For example, skill points. Why not skill points?
Skill points are a good example of something that seems like a good idea. And then you implement it, and then you start playing. And you have the guy who's playing the rogue, who sits down, and he spent one skill point on every single skill in the game. And you realize that, while that seems interesting, that guy effectively can't actually use any of those skills because he's too far behind. You know, it was a case where the way I see it from the design standpoint, is a happy union of this is easier to use, and it's faster, and it actually gets you the result you want. You know, when you have that very granular system, that seems nice in theory, but the problem is now you're stretching your possible values from, you know, 0 to, you know, whatever, your level plus 3. And how do you design for that? Because you don't know where people are going to sit in the middle of that. You know people are going to be at maxed. You know, I'm a 6-level guy and I've put 9 ranks into it. There's going to be people at 0, and there's this potential universe of people in the middle. But as a designer, let's say you're writing an adventure, just kind of come up with, what should this DC be? Well, what should it be? Where should people be? You don't know. I mean, and the easiest fallback was to assume they had maxed ranks. And so, and then the issue there becomes, okay, well, we have the scale. It seems really nice. It goes from 0 to 100. You know, let's say the maximum ranks you could have was 23. So 20th level character. 0 to 23. If you're 20th level, we assume you probably have either 23 or 0. And maybe you're in the middle, but we have no idea. And chances are very few people would do that. So now you're trying to make a DC that either the guy on the high end can make or the guy on the low end simply can't make. I mean, you're talking 0 to 23. That's already, you've gone beyond the die. You know, if the DC that is automatic with a 1 for the guy on the high end is impossible for the guy on the low end. And so the new system is really aimed at making, okay, make this more predictable. Make it so that for the DM, it doesn't have to really think about what DCs do I really need to do. And players aren't feeling like, this looks like I have a lot of choice with all these skill ranks I can spend. But really, there isn't the choice is just maximize as many skills as I can. So that was really the big impetus there.
Okay. You've talked about in seminars and even earlier in this discussion about skill challenges and how they didn't quite come out in the DMG the way you were hoping or the way you would do it now, looking back at it. So if you had the chance, you know, how would you do it? How should we as DMs be running skill challenges?
I think just using the core rules, you know, the DCs and stuff, the first piece of advice would be just think of them more as a structure that you can play with. Really, you have skill checks and you're building toward a number of successes, a number of failures. So don't worry too much about the details of, okay, having people roll for initiative, or, you know, if someone doesn't want to make a check and they have a plausible reason to not do it, don't worry about it. Let them get away with that. Be really open to player ideas. Try to make them vivid by the sense of, don't just have the players. If the players are sitting around rolling dice, that's not really the point. You really want to think of ways to bring them to life. That just like in a combat, a really fun combat's evocative, and you're describing the scenery and the monster's reactions. Do the same thing for a skill challenge. Describe the scenery. Describe how that changes as the players, if they're traveling across the desert, the things they see, or the little, skill checks. Hey, well, you're going across the desert making endurance checks as part of the skill challenge. Well, at one point, a blue dragon flies overhead. What do you guys do? Oh, do you make stealth checks, try to hide, or something like that? And, maybe the dragon swoops down and attacks, or just keeps going. Little curveballs like that to make it more narrative. And, as a DM for the DCs, keep in mind that the DCs in that chart aren't necessarily canonical. We don't see those as, you must use these DCs. Right. They're a starting point. And be aware of what your players are capable, the characters are capable of, and build your DCs around that. Don't be afraid to go, well, this says 25, but really 22 works better for my group. Go ahead and do that.
Good. What about upcoming products? Can you give us some hints as to new power sources that we can expect?
Oh, well, actually, the power sources, we got the PH1 pretty much lists the core power sources, like Primal, Shadow, Psionic, and stuff that we see. So in a way, we've kind of already said, okay, this is what we're going to do.
Sure.
And it's just really a matter of when. Okay. So
looking for each new player's handbook introducing new power sources?
Yes.
Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah.
And doing one player's handbook a year?
That's the plan right now.
Okay,
yeah.
Good deal. Can you promise us at this point, from the perspective of Wizards of the Coast, there is not going to be a 4.5?
Yeah, we don't want to do that.
Okay.
Because 3.5, it's sort of like when you're saying, if you do a new edition, do a new edition.
Right.
And if you're just changing things to fix things up here and there, and especially if you're like, God, you have to really work to figure out what the changes are, it's just, you're just confusing people.
Okay.
And so
one of the common criticisms that things that you hear in joking, oh, I'm not going to buy fourth edition, I'll wait a few months and get 4.5.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think they learned their lesson from 3.5.
I think it just confused people, and it just sort of, it's something where it was kind of an experiment. I wasn't with the company at the time, so I can't really speak to the hows and whys. But, and I can understand the impulse, because you look back and go, oh, we have errata now. There's something we missed. I wish we did this better. But it's really, we're better off probably long term just saying, no, we'll pile those up as we go, and 8 to 10 years from now, if it's time for a new edition, that's when we start going back to that.
Well, and I suppose it probably didn't help the fourth edition marketing.
Yeah.
Because now people are in the boat of thinking, well, it was just 3-4 years ago we had a new edition.
Yeah.
Well, sort of, but not really.
I mean, if you think of different game types, I think in D&D, the value of D&D is learning the rules, and once you have them down, you work on making your campaign world and your adventures and your characters. And so having your rules changed on you is a pretty big deal. You can think, if you're playing a miniatures game, it might not be as big of a deal because you put the value in the miniatures that you've painted, and that you've assembled and stuff. So it's like, okay, the rules have changed, but the thing I spent all my time working on is still here, and I don't have to change that. I think that's what D&D is a bit different, and that changing the rules really does change the character, what's going on.
So going back to discussion a little bit about working for the larger company, there's a lot of discussion and speculation and opinion that a lot of what happens with D&D is because they are Hasbro.
Mm.
How much does Hasbro really have to do with what happens with D&D? I mean, is there a bottom line and they say, you have to make this X number of dollars per year, and if you don't, we're going to...
No, it's just like any other company where there's like, okay, here's, if you want to do projects and, there's profitability targets and stuff, and we project, hey, we're doing this book, we think we can sell this many, so, we work with marketing, brand, design, but we never had anyone from Hasbro show up and say, hey, you need to make fighters different, or, it's the broadest strategic brush I think they paint with.
And they give you some general goals.
Well, it's probably been telling that I'm a manager, I'm the developer, and I have never directly interacted with anyone from Hasbro about D&D. The closest I've come is like, we might have like management training and someone from Hasbro will come by. But yeah, really they're very content to just let us do our own thing. And I think I think fans are pretty quick to say, oh, it says Hasbro here, and I think if Hasbro ever felt they had to step in and really tell us exactly what to do, it would be something kind of strange or odd, or maybe like we made a mistake or something. Because really, they're pretty hands off, as far as what we do.
Okay. And you probably don't have a lot to do with it personally, but being in the company, maybe more aware of what's going on. As the books were launched, the GSL was also launched. There has been a lot of reactions from both fans and third-party people on that.
Yeah, a lot of reactions.
What has sort of been the relationship between Wizards and some of the third-party publishers that have been working with D&D for several years now?
I think it's difficult because I'm friends with people who work at other publishers, and there are a lot of, and this is something where being the big company kind of actually really comes into play, because the sort of view is, you know, hey, you have D&D, it's this big business, big brand, you don't want to just give that away. You know, and I think what we're kind of seeing is in 2000 we had the OGL, which opened up everything super wide open. And I think we're just kind of seeing a reaction and going, okay, let's pull that back a bit and come over to here. In a way, I was talking to a friend of mine that it would have been nice if we could have reversed it. If in 2000 you had something like the GSL, where it's a completely new concept, and people go, okay, this is, we're kind of cautious here, going ahead slowly, and instead of having a flood of products, had maybe a trickle that maybe slowly built up, and over time said, hey, this is going on this path and looks pretty good, maybe we want to be even more open and encourage you more. So I think it's the kind of thing where it went too fast, and now there's basically, you know, course correction here. And it's really, if you look around the industry right now, there's, you know, it's RPGs are in a kind of space where a lot of retailers, you know, they just carry the big names now. And so it's sort of like it's harder for companies to on that end. They want to try to find a way to get into store shelves, to do something exciting, you know, catch that buzz. But, you know, we also don't want, I don't think anyone wants a repeat of 50,000 books a month, you know,
right,
every week, 20 new D20 books. So it's a hard, really hard balance to keep. And it's hard, especially when you consider everyone comes to the table with different desires. And that makes it even harder to juggle. So
is there, I mean, the general sense from third parties, a lot of third party publishers, is that they've really closed it down. Is there some sense that maybe over time the license might loosen up,
I couldn't really say. Okay. That gets into the realm like legal territory, licensing,
sure.
And it's really far above my head. I mean, I think what we'll see, I think it's the sort of thing where time will tell how it plays out.
Sure.
You know, I think in one way, too, it reminds me, in 2000, people remember the big flood of product, but that flood didn't really start coming until that winter. When you think back to Gen Con 2000, a lot of people had the same sort of worries they have now about the GSL that they had about the D20 license. I think that's a better way to think of it, is that this is, GSL is analogous to D20, not to the OGL. That's a very different beast. And, you know, I remember when I got my start, I had access to the playtest rules because of the Living Greyhawk campaign, and I emailed maybe a couple dozen companies saying, hey, do you want to hire me to do a D20 book? And I had one company out of 24 who said yes. The other ones, all of them were just, no, we're not interested. And, you know, this looks like a trap. This doesn't look like it's going to be good business for us. And so I think once you get that first company out there and once you see what happens, I think that'll dictate what happens after that.
So. Now, you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion that you've been playing D&D since, you know, basic set. And so you've gone through many different editions of the game at this point and seen some of the changes and evolutions. And having gone all the way back and looking back at that, can you say that you think the 4th edition D&D feels like,
yes,
D&D?
Oh, yeah. And that's something where, you know, and I hear people say, this doesn't feel like D&D. And you know what? D&D is a very personal thing. And everyone runs it slightly different way. Everyone has their own way of looking at it. And it's possible that if someone says to me, hey, I don't think this feels like D&D, it's not really my place to tell them, well, this is what D&D is.
Right.
But I know for me, and this is very much what D&D feels like. You know,
what is it in 4th edition to you that makes it feel like D&D?
In a way, it's a couple things, but most of it is in the teamwork. And the dwarf's ability to take a second wind is a minor action. Because I think I know what a dwarf is, and I think this is what a dwarf is based on D&D and everything else, this tough warrior guy. And when you're fighting and you're playing a dwarf, you're like, you know what, I can take these hits, I'm going to second wind. And I can do that better than anyone else can. Or if you're an elf and you have an elven accuracy ability, really taking the story of D&D and finding the mechanics to express that maybe prior versions didn't have, where, you know, in combat maneuvers for fighters and stuff, a lot of ways, like, this is stuff I would have described back when I was just making my attack roll, you know, in basic D&D to make the game more interesting, and now it feels like the mechanics are stepping up and making that sort of imagination investment worth it by having mechanics to model the kind of cool stuff that I always wanted in my D&D campaign.
Anything else that you want to say to the listeners?
No, just keep playing D&D, and the hobby is only as strong as people out there playing the game. Game is meant to be played, so get out there and whatever version you like, play D&D.
Well, okay, that's Mike Merles. Now, a quick promo from the Amorphous Blobcast. These are the guys who Mike ran games for at the con for an entire day, and they happen to have a great podcast as well. They don't have an actual promo that I can find, so I want to just tell you a bit about what their show is. They're a group that runs convention games at conventions throughout the season. Their podcast, the Amorphous Blobcast, is sort of their roundtable discussion of different games that they're familiar with. But there is certainly a love for D&D that Tome listeners may find appealing. While opening yourself up a bit to hear about other games, convention play, and general thoughts and advice about gaming. You can find them at abgames.com, which will be linked in the show notes. And that's episode 69. And hey, why don't you email the show at thetomeshow@gmail.com and let us know what you think. Or if you agree, disagree, or are confused by something, hop onto the forums at thetomeshow.com. Also, you can help get the show noticed with reviews or votes on various sites, but more than that, get out there and tell people about the show. Maybe go over to a buddy's computer when he's not paying attention and leave the browser open to thetomeshow.com. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on this show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And once again, you can find all of that at thetomeshow.com. And of course, the Tome continues to work with Fistful of Comics and Games and Gamers Haven. So check out those great shows. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes at the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 69, Mike Merles at Origins 2008 of
The Tome.